This is the Cullinane and Green Report. Today we have a conversation with Marissa Mayer.
Welcome to the Cullinane and Green Report. I'm Joe Cullinane.
And I'm Roger Green. Joe, we have a real treat for our listeners today. Spurred on by the fascinating podcast with Vince Cerf, I recently had the pleasure of spending a day at the Googleplex, Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California. Over the next few weeks, we're going to post the conversations that I had with Google's leaders. I'm sure our listeners will find these podcasts interesting and entertaining. In this edition of the Cullinane and Green Report, I talk with Marissa Mayer about how Google's unique culture and people have made it a phenomenon of our time. Marissa is Vice President of Search Products and User Experience at Google, where she leads the product management efforts on Google search products, web search, images, groups, news, Froogle, the Google Toolbar, Google Desktop, Google Labs, and much more. She joined Google in 1999 as Google's first female engineer and led the user interface and web server teams at that time. Her efforts have included designing and developing Google's search interface, internationalizing the site to more than 100 languages, defining Google News, Gmail, and Orkut, and launching more than 100 features and products on Google.com. Several patents have been filed on her work in artificial intelligence and interface design, and in her copious spare time, Marissa also organizes Google Movies, outings a few times a year to see the latest blockbusters for about 6,000 or more people, which includes employees plus family members and friends. Concurrently with her full-time work at Google, Marissa has taught introductory computer programming classes at Stanford to over 3,000 students. Stanford has recognized her with the Centennial Teaching Award and the Forsyth Award for her outstanding contribution to undergraduate education. Prior to joining Google, Marissa worked at the UBS Research Lab in Zurich, Switzerland, and at SRI International in Menlo Park, California. Marissa has been featured in various publications, including Newsweek, Business 2.0, Business Week, Fortune, and Fast Company. Graduating with honors, Marissa received her BS in Symbolic Systems and her MS in Computer Science from Stanford University. For both degrees, she specialized in artificial intelligence. It's my pleasure to welcome Marissa Mayer to the Cullinane Green Report. I'm sure all of our listeners are going to be most excited to hear what you have to say, Marissa.
Well, it's really exciting to be here.
Thank you. Here is actually at Google's headquarters, and it is exciting to be here for me, too. And I commented earlier that, coincidentally, it is Columbus Day today. And in many ways, I feel like I'm discovering the new world as I have these conversations. So I think it's most appropriate. Tell our listeners a little bit about what your job is. I know the job descriptions don't come anywhere near adequately covering what people do at Google. And I know they'd be very fascinated to hear.
Sure. Well, my title is Vice President of Search Products and User Experience. And what that means is I work on the product management side to define features and functionality for a lot of our core products. And I also spend a lot of time thinking about our end users and the user experience that they have on the site. So products that I work on include web search, the core product, images, Google News, the personalized homepage, some of our client software like Toolbar and Desktop, some of our new initiatives like Google Book Search and Google Co-op and Google Trends, things like that. So a lot of the core products around search and a lot of the ancillary new features that we've brought out.
I know that you're kind of the watchdog for what's ready to go on to the public sites. And in the old days, we used to talk about going from beta to generally available software. Of course, that's no longer relevant. We know that everything is beta all the time now. So how do you know when something is ready to go up?
So the answer is we do have beta and we have full versions. And I think we've abused that over time. And we've been trying to become cleaner in our practices about what's beta. But in terms of when do we launch something publicly, a lot of it has to do with a philosophy we have, which is launch early and launch often. The idea being that we don't want to overinvest in a product. you know, launch it and then find out that we built the wrong thing and we didn't make the end users happy. So we try and launch early enough that there's a core set of functionality there that's compelling, but a lot of times the sort of rounded edges that you'd like to see there, really full-featured functionality, aren't there on the initial version with Google, which is why we often call them beta or launch them on our Google Lab site.
So really, you bring people in and then they can tell you what they really want.
That's right, and there's actually like really some good stories about where this played out. So for Google News, common wisdom would tell you that you should launch products in the first half of the week. It turns out that's when sort of happier news happens. And so we didn't want to launch on a Thursday or Friday. It became pretty clear as we were getting ready to launch it that we were going to miss the Monday through Wednesday window of the current week. So we were going to wait till the next week, which basically gave us 2 or 3 days to build an extra feature the end of that week. So we sat down on Tuesday afternoon and we said, okay, if we have a couple of extra days and we could build one more thing into Google News before it launches, what should it be? There were 6 of us on the team, which was a core problem, which will become obvious later. We sat down and people said, well, one thing we could do is we could have sort by date, right? Because obviously news is all about recency and people are going to want to probably sort and see the freshest stuff first. And then someone else had pointed out that, well, you know, of all news that's consumed, the majority of it is actually local news. People want to be able to find news for things that are near them. And so these both seemed like great ideas. We had them both up on the board, and we debated them for a solid hour. And the team, because it was an even number of 6, came down split. 3-3. Right? So we couldn't make up our mind, sort by date or search by location. And so at the end of the meeting, I realized we weren't going to get anywhere because we were dead tied and we had some very strong-willed people on both sides of the debate. And I said, okay, guys, we're not just going to end up having to launch without either feature. We'll just spend the rest of the week polishing it up, getting more sources, doing all this, and we'll let the users decide. And what was really amazing is a room of 6 very smart people who've been working on this project and working in this space for a good 6 to 9 months couldn't figure out which one was more important.
Right.
And so we launched it on Monday, and by noon, we had 300 emails asking for sort by date.
Wow.
And 3 that asked for search by location. So that's the beauty of launching early and often. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that we actually launched a news product without sort by date, and I'm also kind of embarrassed to say that our team on news didn't realize that recency is 100 times more important than location. but it turns out it really is.
But the most important lesson is don't try to solve every question
up front.
And especially in the absence of knowing what your user really wants.
Exactly.
Because they will tell you, as you discovered. They're not bashful about that. Obviously, what Google does today is as far from a commodity as anyone could describe. And yet, on the other hand, some people would say, well, search is a commodity and advertising is a commodity. But certainly, the construction of what Google has become, this organism that gets so much information of so many different sorts to people, is not a commodity at all. But who do you see as your competitors in the field, and what's your strategy to continue to be the leader and to differentiate?
Well, so Microsoft and Yahoo are our core competitors. And we also have a lot of very able competitors in different geographies. So when you look at how search plays out around the world,
Baidu in China,
Naver in Korea, there's a few companies that are doing really good jobs on search in their particular language or for their particular geography that are very worthy competitors. That said, we don't want to focus on competition too much because we do think that, you know, it's sort of the classic analogy and story of, you know, when you're looking in the rearview mirror, you drive off the road, right? So you don't want to over-focus on the competition. And, you know, that said, we've been working on search as a problem here for a very long time, and we've assembled a group of world experts that we think really are the key people in search and are going to define what the future of search means. And so once you've assembled talent like that, you really do need to look to that expertise to let them define the future because they are the thought leaders as opposed to looking at your competitors.
Sure, sure. Before a common shared vision is arrived at, there are, I'm sure, many individual visions that become components of that. And clearly one of your jobs is to somehow sort through all of those differing views and to create a composite that works.
there are times when there's vision involved and when there's instinct involved. There's no question. But that said, one thing I think that's really very different about Google is the way we rely on data. We're a very data-driven company, and we believe that when you have a really comprehensive set of data and you have a lot of smart people looking at it, they will generally come to the same conclusions about what needs to get done. And we see that happening all the time, be it studying, you know, in our search queries, how many people are searching for news-related topics, how many people are searching for local-related information. That helps us prioritize where we should be putting our efforts. And even doing things like usability studies on our products to try and figure out what's the data around what needs to get fixed and what's the biggest priority. What are usability problems that cause the product not to be usable versus would make it that much nicer? And so when you look at data, be it qualitative or quantitative, it's really helpful to help make these decisions in such a way that it's, you know, arriving at a common vision is easier because it's driven by so much data and it's less about whose opinion did it come from, how well did they make their argument or back it up, and it's a lot more with the data that it's based on.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's the kind of rational approach I'd expect from Google.
I think that, you know, people who have come and observed some of our meetings have found them startlingly academic. And, you know, another anecdote I can tell is we hired someone from another large company. She was one of our first usability analysts. And when she came, she was about to give her first presentation to Larry and Sergey, and she had an executive summary slide that said, you know, most users were unable to complete this task, right? And I just said, okay, wait, like, we're going to have to stay up all night and rewrite this presentation.
Most is not data.
Because, like, Larry and Sergey are going to want to know, how many users was this tested on? How many people failed this task? What did you ask them? Was the question too leading? Was there a bias there? Was there something that caused them, you know, in an external way to be prevented from doing this task? How natural was the setting of the environment? And I said, we can put all that in the appendix, but, like, the statement has to be 5 of 8 were unable to complete the task when phrased as this, and then you're going to have as your appendix the actual script that was used and, you know, as much of the actual data as you possibly can, because, and, you know, she just couldn't imagine that our executives were going to dig into the presentation with that level of detail. And when we walked in the next morning with a much more data-driven presentation and an appendix with all kinds of data, she was startled to find that even with all the data I had asked her for, they actually went deeper. And we still, even with all that data, were sitting there in a situation where they were asking us some questions, and we were like, well, obviously we have that stat. Sorry, it's not in your packet.
Certainly that level of, I'd call it intellectual rigor, was notably absent from everything going on the web for a long time. And probably we wouldn't be trying to ship dog food by UPS, you know, back in those days.
Yes, that's my classic example. Well, I think, you know, Sergey jokes that part of it's intellectual rigor and part of it was his dating life in the end of the 90s. Because he'll say that in order to differentiate himself from other people in Silicon Valley, he needed to be the founder of a profitable .com.
That's truly
a differentiator.
Making
money .com, because everyone was a founder of a .com.
That's funny. My next question was going to be, what makes Google so special? But I think you've begun to answer that already. But are there other things that...
I think there's a lot of things about Google that are unique. So one is that I think we are very data-driven, very analytical, very measured, and, you know, thoughtful in the way that we make decisions. I think that we tend to look very much more at the future and less at competition in the current space, but also where we want to drive the space. But I think that there are fundamental pieces about the culture that make it a very different feeling place, which is maybe some of what you're feeling today.
It is, yeah.
And there's two key elements that I would bring up. One is that Google has a live out loud kind of culture. It was observed to me last year that organizations often mimic the medium that they operate on. So one reason you see these very triangular, hierarchical org charts in corporate America is because it was based on assembly lines. You'd have people along assembly line, you'd need to have a manager for 5 of the people in this area of the assembly line, and then of course there were people who managed, you know, those people, and you end up with this pyramid structure. But that organizational hierarchy was basically defined by the fact that we were working on an assembly line. Because we're working on a network, Google has this very different structure, right? Doesn't have that kind of hierarchy. Different people assume lead roles at different times. Interestingly enough, there's a very open flow of information, which gets me to the sort of live out loud culture. One is you know, you can find out pretty much anything you want to at Google whenever you want to. Right up until about 2 months before the IPO, you could even find out the revenue numbers, right? We think that by giving a lot of smart people access to that kind of information, they'll ultimately make really good decisions. So we try and share as much as we can, which I think is sort of contrary to the Dilbertian office culture, where people broker information.
Right.
They have a piece of information and they gain their power by deciding who they're going to share it with.
And hoarding it.
Fact. And, you know, here you actually find that the people who have the most influence are the people who are at sort of, you know, nexus points of information, who do as good a job as possible disseminating and making sure that people know that this is what we're doing. Oh, did you know this person's doing the same thing as you are, and the two of you should talk, and we should try and get as much out of both efforts as possible.
So
and
instead
it's
of
very
being,
different.
It's not so much like currency anymore. It's now like the lifeblood of the enterprise.
It's interesting because it's almost like the internet itself.
Yeah.
Right? Things are very open. They're very freely structured. There's a lot of information flowing around. And I also think that it's also very participatory. Right, like Googlers are not afraid to take ownership. They're not afraid to speak their mind. Right, I have to justify the decisions I make about the homepage or the result page just as much, right, to the person in, you know, AdWords operations as I do to Larry, Sergey, and Eric. And I might get a harder time from the person in AdWords operations because they just don't like what they're seeing and they might not have access to or have seen as much of the data as we've seen. So I think that, you know, the live out loud culture is very participatory, but it ultimately leads to an approach that's a lot, models very much the wisdom of crowds. Decisions here are made based on data and by consensus and by a huge number of people participating, offering their opinions and insights. You know, it's funny for me because I'm a very shy person. I was always the person in class who never offered things, always waited to be called on. I was very shy. And here I find myself participating a lot more. But I do just think it's a community and an environment where people are really participatory and they're not afraid to jump up and say, hey, who has jumper cables? Or, gosh, isn't that thing we just launched on Google Video ugly? Like, and, you know, like these are threads that go around on our email list in the company. And I think that it is this live out loud culture that comes to, you know, there's a lot of noise in the system, but it ultimately drives us to really good conclusions.
Sure.
So there's a little bit of a culture piece, and then there's also the fact that our workplace is much more a blend of home and work. And I think that ultimately keeps people really productive. So it keeps this sort of, you know, very momentous pace inside the company because people are really motivated, they work really hard, but they also find it a really comfortable place to be. So when you look at, you know, there's dogs in the office and, you know, people bring their kids to dinner because we serve dinner every night in the cafeteria. So when you go down for dinner, it's almost like going home to a family, right? Because there's like whole families down in the cafeteria and people do their laundry here. And our engineers have come up with very complicated systems for how to do the laundry machine switch offs and things. But, you know, it's that kind of home and quirkiness and personality that I think really makes Google who we are internally. And I think that that personality shows in the things that we do. That sort of, you know, I joke that one of the reasons people like the holiday doodles is because they get to see some of the personalities of the people who work here. And so it's almost, you know, people get so used to search, it's like toothpaste. You just, you know, get up and use it in the morning and you don't even think about it. But it's almost like if your tube of toothpaste one day said something to you about the people who work at Crest, right? Like, you know, that would be very surprising and potentially delightful. And when you log on to Google in the morning and you're like, oh my gosh, it's the 50th anniversary of DNA or the 100th anniversary of flight. And I get it. The people at Google are excited about genetics or they're excited about flying, right? Like, you know, those are, I think, are things that do tend to delight people. And I think that we try and have that personality come out in our products.
Well, you've described probably the fantasy lifestyle that I've run into for engineers. The problem is that management tends to think of itself as control. The synonym for management is control in a lot of enterprises, as opposed to empowering and liberating people to do what they already want to do.
It's funny because I do think Larry and Sergey wanted to build a company where they would want to work.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're people, you know, for anyone who's met them, they can only be described as quintessential Montessori kids. They like to challenge authority. They like to ask why. They don't want to take anything for granted, and they don't like to be managed. And, you know, they wanted to create a place where people would be really comfortable working. And, you know, it is true that, you know, I gave a talk a few years ago, and I made a joke that our don't be evil philosophy actually came into existence. It's a longer story, but I'll be brief about it. Came into existence upon the arrival of business people. We had to arrive them. And I gave this talk to a room full of engineers who had the biggest belly laugh ever. I lost complete control of the audience. Like, it took me like a minute to wait for them to quiet down. And while I was happy to have delivered the joke that well, I realized as the laughter continued that there was real pain and resentment in that laughter. And I think that, you know, it's really obvious that, you know, engineers have views about what should get built, how it should get built. It's interesting for me because I think the same way sometimes when we do usability tests with users, we'll say, you know what, this usability test for us is about finding the problem. Right. You don't want the user to prescribe the solution.
Right.
Because they might not understand all the degrees of freedom and the things that you could do. And I think the same thing is true with management. You want to position the problem to the engineers and let them figure out what the best way to solve it is, as opposed to prescribing exactly what they should do or how they should do it.
Exactly.
And so we've tried to make this a more of a playground for engineers where they can vote with their feet and do what they think is right, understand the problems and the data really well, but then build the right things.
Well, clearly the outcomes justify that approach. Now, scaling it, of course, is going to be a tremendous challenge, because scaling anything is a tremendous challenge. That's why we don't see amoebas running around, you know, 80-pound amoebas on the tabletop, because, you know, it just doesn't work. Things get more complex as you scale them. How are you approaching that? And just to add another, I mean, the austerity and the elegance of the Google front page has remained, and I know that you guard over that, and that's all part of it. How do you resist these complicating factors?
So I think there's a couple of things. One, you need to be aware that scaling's hard, and you need to think about it. You need to be aware of what's broken and come up with strategies that fix those things. But I also think that, to some degree, when you over-strategize and overthink, you break things, right? And so to some degree, you know, if you just keep doing what you're doing that is working,
right,
with small changes, as opposed to overcorrections of larger strategy changes, the chance that you break things is a lot less likely, right? So when people ask me, how do you keep the homepage clean? My answer is, they say, how will you keep the homepage clean in the future now that Google is so complicated? And it's going to be even more complicated. My answer is, well, it's looked pretty much the same for the past 7 years, right? So at some point, you know, you just keep doing that. And you just keep applying the same methodology. And the answer is there's more voices to answer to. And the philosophies need to be grounded in even better principles and better data. And there's a lot of data around our homepage. But, you know, that's ultimately one thing to do. I think that a lot of times businesses hit a problem when they overcorrect. One of my friends made this very interesting observation that almost all companies get into a bad state when they move to a new headquarters.
That's interesting.
Because it's interesting when people move, you know, they don't realize what it was about their old space that made the organization work.
Right.
That the hallways were a little more narrow and forced more conversations. That the way people sat, they were closer together and talked more, right? And they don't understand what worked about their space. So when they move to a whole new building, it just breaks everything. And it takes them a while to get back into the groove of things. And so I think, you know, so that's sort of like a very physical manifestation of an overcorrection.
But a very real one.
Right. It's a very real one that can occasionally. So that's why we, you know, you'll notice like Google hasn't built a new headquarters. I don't think we ever will, because we've all heard this theory from one of the people who helped out with Google. And, you know, we were really happy to, you know, just come move into and modify an existing building. Mm-hmm. Say, you know, look, this has been lived in. We know this worked for this culture. We're going to switch it around because, you know, for example, we have external offices with a lot of glass and internal cubes, so we had to do some restructuring. But it was interesting because we were very methodical about not changing what worked in our old space. It was always 3 people per office. You know, we had external offices and internal cubes, and the hallways were about this wide, and we had, you know, snack rooms scattered around the building to facilitate conversations, and we tried very hard to capture all that, you know, formalize it, and when we moved in here, one, move into an existing space that we knew worked well for a company, and then make those modifications and make sure we really preserved what worked for us. But it's those types of things. When you think about scale, I think it's important, one, to realize what's broken and make sure that you fix that, but also not to overcorrect.
Right, right. I think those are very good points. So with that being said, so how do you think Google and this model will look in 5 years? What do you think will change?
I think that is an interesting question. My guess is that, you know, we'll be several multiples larger than we are now in terms of people. And I think that a lot of the core principles and values around, you know, 20% time, the fact that people get to spend 1 day a week doing what they want to do, the empowerment of engineers and a real focus on technical excellence and a real focus on end users will persist. And I do think that Larry and Sergey are going to want to continue to propagate a culture where if they themselves were engineers, they'd like to work. So I think all of those things are true. That said, I'm sure that there will be more groupings, more more layers of management of just sort of like thematic things, clustered together. It's hard to say. There's always a trade-off between functionally and divisionally organized companies. And right now, Google's a functional company, right? Engineers report to engineers. Product managers report to product managers.
Right.
And that's worked very well for us. Whether or not we would switch to a divisional business unit structure, I'm not sure. I think that, Eric often points out that for all intents and purposes, Google has one product, which is that website. There's a lot of other features and things that we've put on it.
That's true.
But it's basically one product, and that's why there's basically one business unit. And we've, in smaller instances where things are very segmentable, like our Google Search Appliance, which is our enterprise box that we sell to corporations, we have segmented that off and had that operate as a separate business unit. So I think there might be more things like that that have happened in the future as our product lines expand. But I would guess it's going to sort of have the same free-form, organic quality.
How about the internet? What do you think is going to happen there?
I think that, a lot of the participation, mashups, some of the things that are happening on social networking and MySpace and Facebook are really, truly fascinating. And I think that right now we're at a point where the younger generation has embraced and adopted this and really uses it to their advantage. And I'm not sure the whole population will. And I think that in 5 years we'll be over that point of fear and people will be relying on it and adopting a lot more. I think people also understand how to use it a lot more. I think that we'll have operating systems that look a lot more like the fabled network operating system,
right,
where your data gets stored in the cloud and you can access it from anywhere. You don't have to have the physical box that you created it on and saved it on with you. So I think that ultimately will change over the next few years. And I hope that there'll be just a lot more information and participation out on the web, because I think that benefits everyone. But I also think that there are, serious threats that could curtail it. I personally was really worried about net neutrality.
Yes.
Because I think, interestingly enough, the companies that are lobbying against net neutrality, and it's a charged name because it's very hard to be against neutrality, but if you look at the actual way it works, it's not really neutrality. But when you look at the companies that are lobbying against it, eBay, Yahoo, Google.
Yes.
The truth is, we're not the people who are going to be affected by net neutrality, because we have the resources and the funds, and
right,
we would ultimately, if something like that happened, we would ultimately, pay for the faster pipes. What ultimately will happen is I think it will actually curtail free speech and free information on the web, because when it will, right now you can put up a web page and be like, I can put up this web page and my friends can see it later today and somebody in Bangladesh could see it next week, right? And there is that empowerment of the fact that your information could be found, right? Where if you have to pay for faster bandwidth, because we actually know here at Google that users are incredibly sensitive to speed.
Oh,
so,
yes.
So when you think like, does it really matter fast pipes or not fast pipes for that sort of second tier, just somebody coming up with a web page content, isn't it okay if it's slow? The answer is that people are incredibly responsive to it. So if you have something to say and you have the slow pipe, the odds that you don't get discovered are that much greater. And if you don't get discovered, we may have been in a situation where that person says, I could write a web page, but what's the point? And I think that hurts everyone. So I do, I think that overall, when you look at the ecosystem of the web, there's a lot of incredibly powerful, impacting, exciting things happening. But I do think there's a few things that could happen along the way in the next 5 years that could really alter it in ways that would be really disappointing.
Yeah.
And so it's important for us to understand what the ramifications of those might be, really embrace the, initial charge of the internet, of open standards, equal participation, user annotation, right? When you look at some of
right.
the early things
right.
that, Berners-Lee did, and, just the concept of hyperlinking, it
right.
really comes down to annotations. I think that we want to make sure that that really stays empowered.
Those are really good points, and it is worrisome. When we interviewed Vince Cerf about a month ago, he also talked quite a bit about net neutrality. We encouraged him to. And it was actually scary to hear about some of the scenarios that could play out, because obviously the entrepreneurial spirit could be dampened quite a bit by that kind of move. So when we talked about who the competition is, and we see that, because I don't think either of the companies that you mentioned as competitors were the ones pushing in unneutral net. So maybe the competitors are really coming from another place entirely. Maybe it's the companies that are cable phone companies and so forth that are trying to hammer it into a shape that looks like something they would offer their people.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say. I don't really know where our competitors lay on the issue. I think that I understand would hopefully be in the best interest of the web, and I think that it's also in their interest then as well. But it is a hard issue, and I do think that we're seeing something grow up in the ecosystem of the web that's very different in terms of an organism than it's ever happened before. And when you look at this idea of fast pipes and slow pipes, it starts to look a lot more like, say, like something like cable TV.
Right.
Where there's a couple of condoned channels that are picked up by various carriers. And I understand why that would be comfortable and why that would be something that businesses would want to push for, because it's a business model that they understand. But, you know, wouldn't it be a lot more exciting if there were, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of TV channels, you know, and TV programs and video programs being created? And I think that's what's so exciting about YouTube and Google Video.
Absolutely.
Is you can look out there and you can say, you know what? Like, you don't need to be on one of the 500 condoned cable channels to have a piece of great content that's worth 3 minutes of somebody's time.
Exactly. The word control is really the operative word there. And it's like yeast, you know, we need, it needs to be free. I know you get interviewed quite a bit. I know you get asked a lot of questions. What's the question that no one ever asks you that you wish they would? And would you like to answer that for our listeners?
That's a good question. I have to think for a second. There's a lot of questions people ask me around privacy. And, you know, a lot of times they're very slanted questions around, you know, isn't this the downfall of privacy? And isn't that a horrible thing? Because privacy is a really important thing, and to the degree that it gets degraded, it is worrisome. But I think that the flip side of the question never gets asked, which is, assuming that you give up some privacy, what can you get back in exchange?
What's the social contract?
Right, and I think that exactly, the social contract. Because, like, the answer is people make social contracts all the time. We tell the government a lot about ourselves. We tell the DMV a lot about ourselves for the sake of driving. Right, okay, right? Like, you know, there are really empowering things that could happen by you giving up a little bit of your privacy to the internet. And what you see is, you know, content and search could be tailored a lot more to you. When you look at things like YouTube and Google Video, if you allow us to actually keep track of the types of things you're interested in, the types of videos you've clicked on in the past, we could actually tailor make a TV channel for you of content that we know you'll like.
Exactly.
And relevance is
really a big issue for people.
And relevance, really, I think, is the holy grail. When I look at sort of where search is going 20 years out, because a lot of times, you know, 6 months is easy, because anything we're going to do in the next 6 months, we basically have in the oven
right
now. And, you know, in five years or 10 years out, I think an easier way to structure strategy questions. Because when you look at that 5, 10, 20-year out range, you can ask big, broad questions like, will there be a search engine in 2020 that understands more about you, and as a result of knowing more about you, is better than Google is today? And to me, the answer to that question is very clearly and obviously yes. I don't know what it will know. Maybe it'll know your zip code. Maybe it'll know your first name. Like, I don't know what it would know about you, but I can hypothesize that it's clear to me that search engines will learn a new piece of data they want to know about their users sometime over the next 14 years.
Even if they just know where you are when you're asking.
Right. That will ultimately cause their, or maybe, you know, just that, what are your favorite websites? So when
you
type favorite websites into Google, it gives them back to you. Like, it could be something that simple, but that, you know, it ultimately will know a little bit more about you, and as a result, the search engine will be better than what you get as the state-of-the-art Google today. And so from that perspective, do we need to embark on personalization initiatives? Absolutely. Do we need to try and understand what we could give the users in exchange for some of the information we could get? Absolutely. But does that mean that ultimately people are going to have to become more comfortable in a world where they have made this social contract and given up a little bit of their privacy, maybe not even a lot, but a little bit of their privacy in order to have that better relevance? Because especially when you look at the incredible explosion of content happening, right, there's influx points in the web, and I think we're going to hit another one over the next 5 years, right? Because when the web began, Yahoo, like directory structures, were great. Because you could take a couple million web pages and you could actually classify them into a hierarchy,
right,
and that was an efficient and effective way to surf. The rise of Google was basically the breaking of that.
Yes.
Once there was too many websites, you know, that worked for millions, but once you got to tens of millions and then hundreds of millions, you couldn't get at everything, and you needed search. right? And when you look at this next explosion of content that's going to happen, search is going to be very important in that, but it may even be like search based on topic plus an understanding of you, right? It may be a personalized search engine that will ultimately be the knife that you need to cut through all that and say, okay, I understand there's all this content in the world, but here's what I have time for today.
One size does not fit all.
For you to be able to figure out how I should fill the next hour of my time reading the thing that's best, you're probably going to have to know more about me.
Well, that's very thought-provoking, and I think you've nailed it, too. We were talking about that earlier. I think that people do recognize that they have to contribute, if you will, to get back. And
sure.
Certainly in this case, information is what we're talking about. Well, it's been fascinating chatting with you, Marissa. I've really enjoyed it a lot. And as always, so far I've learned something for every person at Google I've talked to. It's been great. Would you be willing to talk to us again in the future as time goes on and update us on what you're doing and what the company's doing? We'd love to have you back on.
Sure, that would be great.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Cullinane and Green Report. We hope you'll join us again next time. In the meantime, remember, we're on the bleeding edge, so you don't have to be.